As I begin, not knowing what to write, the sun, from the clip on my pen, turns on this page, such a streaked, burst gold eye, all I have ever wanted, you, to see this, to see with this, in case it is dark where you live.
Poet William Hayen. He'll be back in just a moment with more from his most recent book, a collection of poems entitled The Host. Welcome to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Word things. That's how William Hayen describes his work as a poet over the last 30 years. His most recent book, a collection entitled The Host, brings together a sampling of 12 previous books of verse. William Hayen is here now to read from The Host and to talk about the place of poetry in contemporary American society. Hayen writes about a diversity of subjects and themes, ranging from sports, boyhood, and hero worship, to historical enormities such as the Holocaust. He reflects on nature and the environment, on home life and married love. He reacts to American foreign policy and violence in our society. In a review of The Host, Joyce Carol Oates called these poems strong and beautiful, the work of a poet in whom the visionary and the unblinkingly historical are dramatically meshed. With a poem entitled Harpoon, here is William Hayen.
I think this poem, Harpoon, is one that holds within it conflicting emotions. And you'll hear these, I think. Harpoon. Now that blue whales are as few as 200, I want the last one dead. I need to forget them right away, before the last reports. Ships stripping lost codes of flesh. The last calf wandering away, and, later, are there any left? Before the last eye is cut out, dumped overboard, and floats away, and what it sees. Kill them now, please, before politics can't save them. The fountaining overtures, the biblical jaws, the blue tinge fathoms deep, the evolutionary curves, our predecessors' pitiful and beautiful last songs.
William Hayen, welcome to the National Humanities Center. I congratulate you on these wonderful poems that you have written. Give me a sense of what you are like as a poet. What do you care about? What drives your poetry?
Wayne, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. You know, I find myself in life as in a strange garment, as W.S. Merwin mentions in one of his poems. It seems to me when I was a kid, I just wanted to play ball, you know, and play poker and, as a friend of mine says, drink whiskey and pan for gold. But somehow I came to poetry in college and in graduate school, and I think it chose me. I didn't choose it. I mean, I feel I have to write. I'm just driven toward the poem. And about what it is I'm primarily interested in, you know, Theodore Rethke has a line. He says, "By long staring I have come to be." It's a tremendous line. I mean, he actually says that he doesn't exist except by way of what he stares at. And it just seems to me that what we do in our lives is to pay what Frost called passionate attention. And I stare at things. When I was a boy, I think I primarily stared at nature, and I continue to do that. And then now I try often to stare into history, and have come to some of my books on the Holocaust and by way of my reading. So I keep staring.
One of the things that you stared at when you were a kid, Bill, is baseball.
I did.
And here we're recording this conversation at a moment when, you know, the game looks kind of bleak, all this strike, and, you know, will we have more seasons and the no World Series in the fall of 94? You've got a poem called Mantle. I'd like you to read this for me.
Wayne, this is a poem called Mantle, about my boyhood hero. Mantle ran so hard, they said, he tore his legs to pieces. What is this but spirit? 52 homers in 56, the Triple Crown. I was a high school junior, batting fourth behind him in a dream. I prayed for him to quit before his lifetime dropped below 300, but he didn't, and it did. He makes Brill Cream commercials now, models with open mouths draped around him, as they never were in Commerce, Oklahoma, where the sandy-haired, wide-shouldered boy stood up against his barn, lefty for an hour, Ruth, Gehrig, then righty, DiMaggio, as his father winged them in, and the future blew toward him, now a fastball, now a slow curve hanging like a model's smile.
Bill Hahn, we have just heard you read Mantle, a poem about your boyhood romance. I guess that's a fair word to use here. This is a love poem, isn't it?
I think so.
To Mickey Mantle. Another of your considerations, your preoccupations as a poet, is with the environment. Here is a poem I'd like you to read called Red Wings. This is a poem that goes not only to nature, but to transcendence. Tell me about this.
I've got a poem that's kind of mysterious to me. I think it's about someone who sees something very beautiful. It reminds him, maybe, of what is transcendent in us. I think this is a happy poem. Red Wings. Maybe you've noticed that around here, red-winged blackbirds aren't rare, but aren't seen often, either. And then, at distance, banking away from roads as we pass. But one morning, I saw 100, more, feeding on seed I'd scattered under a line of pines planted more than 100 years before. Almost at rest, their feathers folded close, only yellow wing bars break their black bodies. But when, as they did, all at once, they lifted that red. I've tried for a long time, and maybe should, to tell you how the disembodied red wings flared and vanished. I've lost them in every telling. So much for me. I could die now, anyway. Could you? We will close our eyes and rest, in case the blackbirds, in slow motion, assume again the flames they are, and rise.
Bill, you've just read to us your poem, Red Wings. How did you create this poem? What happened in your mind to bring it about?
I don't remember it specifically, although I probably had an experience like that, seeing red wings lift up. But I think we're losing the world. We're losing our water. We're losing the land. We're losing the air that we breathe. And I think one of the things we need to do is to just see. We need a reality check. We have to see what it is, how beautiful things are, how the flesh can make the spirit visible, uh-huh. as a poet says. And I think it was that that experience that I wanted to capture there.
How do you cross the line or combine your interests as a poet, Bill, with the, forgive me if I use a harsh word here, the preachiness, you know, the kind of moralizing about reclaiming the world and being responsible to the environment? You creative types don't like to preach, and yet, after a fashion, that's what you're doing here.
We have to be very careful. We do not want to be hit over the head with a blunt stick. And I think we try to reach a language that holds a great many things inside it at once. But the most important thing is that a poem goes on writing itself, and we have to be suggestive, I think, suggestive.
I use the word transcendence in describing this poem, Bill Hahn. Is it about religion, spirituality? How do you take it out into the world?
I don't know, but Richard Wilbur, for example, says that Poe's aesthetic is insane. Thoreau wants to break out right away and jump into the ethereal right. world, while Whitman bases his religion, if you call it that, on our earth. Uh-huh. What we have is what we have. But we also have intimations of something going on beyond us. Whitman says, I'm not contained just between my shoes and my hat.
Right.
So I believe that about the natural world. If we can keep staring, then we can get at those meanings that are beyond words, really, even as we use words.
Now, you mentioned Walt Whitman. You've opened a door here. Your poetry, after a fashion, is poetry because you call it poetry and because it gets published as poetry. But it doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have all of that aesthetic jingle to it. You've told me that you want your poems to be very conversational. Tell me about this.
I do, but I work terribly hard on concentration. I mean, Yeats says that the poet's job is to labor and labor over a line until it seems to have come spontaneously. But I do think there's a great deal of rhyme in my poetry. Assonance, consonants, different kinds of rhyme. Rhythm is rhyme also.
How conscious are you of all these literary devices as you what comes first?
As I write, I try not to be conscious at all. We have to suspend our critical faculties, I think. There's a different dimension operating. Later on, I think during the process of revision, we can worry about some of those other things.
Bill Hayne, we're talking about your poetry. I want to turn to a very serious subject here. This is a poem called The Candle. Here's a poem about the Holocaust. I'd like you to set this up for me and read it, and then we'll talk about it.
This Holocaust poem, Wayne, called The Candle, is about entering the darkness of that theme. The speaker of my poem resists, but something in him draws him in. I'd like my listeners, I think, just to remember what Archibald MacLeish said, that poetry is a music that means. The candle. It would do me no good to travel to Auschwitz. It would do the dead no good, nor anyone else any good. It would do me no good to kneel there, me nor anyone else alive or dead, any good at all. I've heard that in one oven a votive candle whispers its flame. When I close my eyes, I can see and feel that candle, its pitch aura, its tongues of pitch luminescence licking the oven's recesses. A survivor, 40 years later, crawled up into an oven and laid down. What of his heart? Could it keep pumping its own pitch light, here where God's human darkness grew darkest? Whoever you were, please grant me dispensation. Rudolf Hess praised the efficiency of these ovens. It would do me no good to travel to Auschwitz, to kneel or lie down. It would do me or God, or anyone else alive or dead, or anyone else neither alive nor dead, no good, no good at all. The survivor did crawl back out of the oven. He took his heart with him, didn't he not? It kept beating. He left his heart in the oven, and it keeps beating, black, 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 the candle of the camps. Eyes closed, staring up into this, eye beams of pitch luminescence, and the pulse of it, the heart, the candle. You and I, haven't we not, have met him, the one who lay himself down there, where the Nazis had missed some. Welcome, welcome home. We have spoken the candle heart of the camps. It does the dead no good, nor us any good, doesn't it not? But it keeps, black, black, its watch of pitch light and will. Any good at all, wouldn't we not? The candle.
Should I accuse you here, Bill, of being very morbid? My goodness, I mean, this is the dreariest, the darkest of subjects. How does a poet come to this?
You know, I wrote these poems for years. They chose me for years and just left them in a desk drawer and didn't think they could ever become a book or would become a book. Because of just what you said, I couldn't imagine anybody who'd want to read a book that could be this dark and unrelieved and unrelenting. You know, I began reading different things, and Susan Sontag says that the Holocaust is opaque. And she says it might not do any good, but that remembering serves a moral function. So finally I began to have faith in some of these poems that I was was doing.
Do you want your readers to experience pain and discomfort, the horror, and to use the phrase of one of our great writers here, when we think about the Holocaust, how uncomfortable should we be?
Well, this is a big question about what any poet would like his audience to experience. Anne Sexton quotes Kafka, who says that we need art as an axe for the sea that is frozen within us. So I would like there to be an emotional experience, at the same time not an experience that debilitates anybody.
Bill Hahn, let's turn to another serious subject. I want you to read for me. Here is a poem called Matrix. This is intensely personal, very serious. It is about dealing with cancer in your own family. Tell me about this poem.
Matrix is a poem that I first included in a book of ecology poems, and I think you'll be able to hear why. Matrix. When I was a boy, I found a mutilated turtle emerging from mud. Something, when it was young, had broken its shell almost in half, but the shell, as though welded with glossy solder, had mended. Something had chewed its back legs to the joints, but its stumps were hard. How did you survive? I asked it. But it was mute, still half a dream from its winter sleep. I spoke to it, warmed it in my boy's hands, but it boxed itself up. For some time after her mastectomy, weeks of hospital and chemotherapy, my wife woke toward me in slow spirals as though from ether, unsure of where we were or how we'd live in our new matrix of scar and fear. But it was April again. In windows before us, as we changed her dressings, the days rained and warmed. One morning, I pressed my lips to her chest until, at last, she believed and opened up to me, our answers so slow to come that came.
Bill Hahn, you've just read to us here this poem called Matrix. This is about cancer, the possibility of death. This is very intensely personal. How do you pull this off? How do you experience something like this and then write a poem that you float out into the world?
Well, I don't know. And it is based on my wife's mastectomy 5 years ago. When this happens and the word comes to us that this is necessary, then it concentrates the mind. In the case of this poem, which is a strange one, I didn't know that that was going to come up when I began writing about that boyhood memory of that turtle.
Was this, first of all, a personal experience or an artistic experience? How do you move back and forth between the two?
That's a good question. I don't know. First of all, I'm living in my life, of course. And then maybe some time goes by, and maybe it's necessary time, when these kinds of happenings become concentrated almost into symbol within us. Then if we're lucky, we find a language that carries it.
Was it a therapeutic experience for you? A working out, cathartic, all of that sort of thing?
I do believe in poetry as meditation, the poem of the mind in the act of finding what will suffice, Wallace Stevens says, and I guess to that extent it was. Yes.
What effect do you want this poem to have on your readers?
Well, I think this is a love poem and it's uplifting, and many people have come toward me after readings, many women, to say thank you for writing that poem. So it was April again, and the poem lifts up, and there's a great deal of hope there during a time when one out of nine American women will suffer from breast cancer.
William Hahn, we're talking about your poetry. You have any number of collections. The two I have here in front of me, one called The Host and another one called Ribbons, The Gulf War. Let's turn our attention to these poems about the Gulf War. You are the first poet, have I got this right, who really wrote a whole long sequence of poems about the war in the Gulf?
So far as I know, I've seen scattered poems here and there, and there is at least one anthology, but I seem to be where I carried through on a book-length poem.
All right, I want you to read this poem called The Heart. This is a poem about violence and the Gulf War. Again, it's in this collection called Ribbons. Tell me about this.
The Heart, Wayne, is a section of my book, Ribbons, about the Gulf War. This poem is pretty rough, but I think finally it's about the cycle of violence that we hope to break. The heart. One mid-century Long Island afternoon, I biked over for some schoolyard basketball. My older brother Werner and his friends, that melting pot gang, Tony Rohde, the Blumbergs, Ernie Olson, Prez, Riley, and the rest. Later, they were just hanging around, smoking, telling dirty jokes, when one of them, I've blocked out who, mentioned a movie playing in Smithtown, a war movie. He said you saw a Japanese soldier cut the heart out of an American prisoner. He said the prisoner was still alive and tied to a stake, and the Jap had to raise a sharp sword and cut the heart right out of the prisoner's chest, right through bone, and held it in his hands. I am 50 now and have heard, I guess, almost everything. I have read Kraft Ebbing, True Stories of Genitals in Soup, and have followed serial murders on television, have witnessed secondhand such lurid torture and dismemberment that I am almost shock and compassion immune. I have seen an American president's head blown apart, bits of his brain and skull sticking to his wife's pink skirt, and have been to Bergen-Belsen, where Anne Frank died. But I was only 10 that afternoon when, for the first time in my mind, a human body was cut open, its heart removed, and I could not breathe well or sleep well for a long time. And this morning, watching television news, I heard a young political science major, one Randall Alden, being interviewed at the University of California at Irvine about this war in the Gulf, which he was for 100%, and if it were not concluded very soon, he urged bombing civilians and deployment of U.S. tactical nuclear weapons. And for him, the Iraqi people were not people, and our oil economy was his religion. And I lost hope, for I knew then what had become of the American whose heart had been cut out.
Bill Hahn, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let me present you with a very big order. What are you up to as a poet? Here in The Host, we have collected works from, 25 years of your life as a poet? What are you saying to people?
25 years of writing, and it was hard to pick the poems that I did. And I, of course, I tried to pick the best ones. What am I up to? Well, I might be the last one to be able to see. I do believe in what Whitman called ensemble, the thing as a whole. William Stafford says that he believes in any poem and going into any direction at any time. But he was surprised looking back to see how often he'd gone in the same direction.
Right.
I'm not sure what that same direction of mine might be. But again, it has to do with staring. It has to do with witnessing. And it has to do with being of use, maybe.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to people when you tell them that you're a poet? I mean, isn't that a sort of a crazy profession? You know, poets are crazy people who live in attics. They do strange things. They live crazy lives. And yet you're telling me in these poems that poets are deeply engaged with the culture, that they have things to say about the way we live.
Well, I never use that word. I think, I don't know, maybe when I get to be 75 or 80, if I've treated the language right, I can call myself a poet. Right now, I'm an aspirer. It's not something I'm embarrassed about, but I'm a person who seems to find it necessary to write these word things.
Bill, I want you to reflect on this for me. What is the role of the responsibility of the poet in our mass culture? This is a very big order, but it's the kind of thing that I take it you think about from time to time.
Well, the glib answer is to say that the role of the poet is to write poems, but I know it's a more serious question than that. I think it's to testify, to witness, to see things, and also to say things clearly, to remind us of things. All of that sounds sort of trite and corny, but I think those are the things.
Well, fair enough. But, I mean, is there, you know, to argue with you here for a moment, is there a kind of an arrogance at work here? You know, I mean, after all, who relegates or who separates the poets off into being the sort of national conscience? What kind of chutzpah does that take?
I don't know, and I suppose there are some arrogant poets around, and there are poets around that, to my mind, have given up on actually communicating with many people, uh-huh. You know, but no, I feel as dumber than the day I was born. So I'm just fumbling my way forward to try to say something clearly. And if I ever manage to do that, I'm as surprised as anybody else.
William Hayen's new book of poems, The Host, is available from Time Being Books. The Host is a selection of Hayen's work from 12 other books of poetry. William Hayen is a professor of English at the State University of New York at Brockport. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was William Hayen of the State University of New York at Brockport. Audio cassettes of this program are available postpaid for $10. Please write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 748. That's program number 748, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. We're also interested in your comments and suggestions. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ecsvax.uncecs.edu. Next week on Soundings, the first in a series of programs for Black History Month 1995. Join me over the next 4 weeks for conversations about the music of Duke Ellington, the lives and legacies of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., African-American scholarship, and political leadership in the African-American community in the United States today. My guests will be Mark Tucker of Columbia University, Michael Eric Dyson of UNC Chapel Hill, Adam Fairclough of St. David's University College, and John Hope Franklin of Duke University. Meanwhile, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.